If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA Playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA Playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This case was exceptional in Iceland. There had been very few murder cases, I think maybe one murder a year at the most, and always cases of domestic violence. So the police themselves would say they were completely out of their depth. They'd not seen anything like this before.
That was Dylan Howitt discussing a major murder investigation in Iceland in the 1970s.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Next Monday, the 14th of August, BBC 4 will be broadcasting a documentary entitled Out of Thin Air, which tells the story of the disappearance of two men in Iceland in 1974. It led to one of the most dramatic investigations in the country's history, and even now questions remain to be answered. The film's director is Dylan Howitt, and he spoke to our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Your film Out of Thin Air considers two disappearances in Iceland in 1974 and then the subsequent investigation into six young people who were suspected of these disappearances. Perhaps you could just start by introducing us to Iceland in the early 1970s.
I mean, Iceland in the 1970s was sort of going through huge changes. It had been a tremendously poor and kind of isolated country, in a disconnected kind of cold place stuck up there in the North Atlantic. And also quite not many people. I think about in 74, there's probably about 215,000 people in total. Reykjavik was quite a small town, 85,000 odd people. And it was a tremendously homogenous place as well in terms of the population, you know, descendants of Vikings and Celts and little else. And it had been basically run by the Danes for quite a while. They only won their independence in 1944. So it's this like I say quite an isolated place. But it was suddenly going through these great changes because in the Second World War, Britain had actually occupied or had a base there, not occupied but had a base there in the sort of, I think, about 43, 44. And then the Americans came with a base and they built an airport. And suddenly money was coming to Iceland, and they went from being a very poor country to actually being relatively wealthy in Europe in a very short period of time. So society was changing greatly over this period. And it's worth saying, and this is something that Iceland always say to you, that it was a very rural society and still is. They always say, you know, Icelanders are just farmers and fishermen.
In amongst this this very rural kind of community, then you introduce us in your film to this kind of more liberal hippie scene that was happening around the world, but also happening in Iceland and Reykjavik as well.
It was quite a small scene, I think. It was only really in Reykjavik and Keflavik, partly because of the American base and the music that was coming in through there. And there was actually a TV station and a radio station run by the Americans that locals could get. And so they were starting to hear music from the outside world, and there was starting to be bands formed, Icelandic bands, and the sort of very small scene developing. And then also drugs coming in for the first time, so sort of marijuana, LSD was starting to come in, and people describe it as always having a little bit of a lag from the rest of Europe. So the sort of 68 big eruptions in Europe didn't come to Iceland for a few years, I don't think. So it was really that then in the early 70s that you started to get that happening. And I think that was quite a threat to the older generation, from what people told me as I was making the film.
And then within this community, the country's kind of rocked by these disappearances. First one that's a bit more innocuous, and then the second, which kind of links the two and leads to one of the biggest investigations in Icelandic history. Can you perhaps introduce us to the disappearances?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the first one was a man named Gudmundur Einarsson. And in January 1974, he'd gone out drinking with some friends at a nightclub in Hafnarfjordur, which is close to Reykjavik. And he'd left the club in the middle of a snowstorm, actually, saying he was walking back home to his home near Reykjavik. And he was seen by a couple of people walking home. Some people saw him with another guy, other people saw him on his own. And that was the last he was seen. And so that made the news, and that there were searches for him. But it was never thought of as suspicious, because that had happened before in the past in Iceland, that people had just kind of got lost. It's quite a brutal landscape if anyone who's been there, and weather as well. The weather can turn, you know, very quickly. So it wasn't thought of as suspicious. But later that year, there was a second disappearance, a guy called Geirfinn Einarsson, no relative, but that did seem suspicious. And this was a man who had been, so that what we know of his last movements, he'd gone to this his local cafe in Keflavik harbour, and had sort of been waiting around. It seemed like he was waiting for someone. He'd been seen there, and then he'd gone home, and he'd received this strange phone call where he was heard to say, "Oh, I've been there already. I'll come back." And he drives back to the cafe, he leaves his car, and then he just disappears. So clearly, he was there going to meet someone. And there was some witnesses who saw somebody in the cafe making a phone call at the same time that Geirfinn had got his phone call. So that the phone call was made from the cafe to Geirfinn's house. But that was it. So that second disappearance really made the news, and it really caught the public imagination. And the media really whipped that up as well. So who was this man? Who was this mystery man who made the phone call that Geirfinn was going to meet? And, you know, the police immediately thought this was a murder or something suspicious. They called it a murder investigation quite quickly. They called a press conference that went out on TV. And immediately people were talking about, you know, what had happened, and, you know, And it kind of spiraled from there, really.
And how was it that the two disappearances then came to be linked by the media, by the police?
Well, that's quite a mysterious question. At the time, they weren't. So in 1974, they weren't connected by anyone. We kind of rounded up and first confessed to being involved in Gudmundur's disappearance, the police then started asking about the Gerdfinn disappearance as well. And so, and the police have never given a really good reason why they made that connection, why they suddenly started switching, why they switched from one to the other. They say that the four guys and a woman started talking about Gerdfinn, just started speaking about him. The defendants or the accused say that the police started talking about it, so that's in dispute. So there's these five characters who are arrested under suspicion of being involved in the disappearance of Gudmundur. So there's this kind of couple at the heart of the film and of the story, really, which is a man named Sævar Sisielski and his girlfriend Erla Bolladottir. And Sævar was a kind of a known petty criminal. He was known by the police. He smuggled marijuana for a living. He also was involved in petty thievery. And he was kind of surrounded by this group that was seen at the time as kind of a group of thugs, all of whom were involved in kind of petty crime. And some, I think one of them had been involved in an assault and things like that. Sivers a really interesting character. He was quite an easy person to kind of scapegoat in a way, and quite an easy person to target, partly because, everyone says he was a very charming guy and he's a good looking guy. But he was kind of surrounded by these thugs, almost like bodyguards or something. And he was quite charismatic and quite controlling, it seemed. And he never seemed, even though he sold drugs, he was never involved in drugs. So that was part of why he was given this kind of almost Charles Manson-esque kind of, that's how he was given this kind of label almost, of that he was this charismatic, controlling figure. His girlfriend, Ertla, was the one who the first to confess about the Gudmundur case. And they were all involved loosely in the hippie scene at the time. I think by kind of mainstream Icelanders, they were probably seen as kind of lowlifes, you know, people who didn't really work for a living, people who were involved in petty crime, people who took drugs, perhaps, things like that.
So your film investigates then how these people were linked by the police to these disappearances and deals with their confessions. You investigate thoroughly in the film how these confessions were unreliable. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So this is when the case starts to get really mysterious, because ostensibly when Ertla and Sævar are arrested, it's for another crime that they'd committed together, which was the embezzlement of a post office. After some days of being in custody, Ertla is questioned about the Gudmundur disappearance, quite out of the blue, it seems. About a week into the custody, she's questioned about that. And she says she knows nothing about it, but she does know Gudmundur. She had met him before, and so the police kind of hone in on that, and they say, we think you know something about this. You know, if you know this guy, you really need to think. And so she's put back in the cell, and she's thinking back to that weekend when he disappeared. She was living in the same town at the time, and she remembers that she'd had this very strange nightmare that night he disappeared. So she relates that to the police, and the police become quite excited and quite convinced that this relates to the disappearance of Gudmundur. So they hold her still for longer, and they question her further. And eventually she confesses, and this is the first confession in the case, that she saw Sævar and Christian, one of his friends, and another guy carrying what looked like a body in a sheet, standing in her bedroom door. She witnessed them going past the door, and that's the kind of beginning of the story in a way. And then I think the following day, Sævar confesses that he was involved in the killing of Guðmundur, and that they wrapped his body in a sheet. And then a further two people confessed the same.
So how did these disappearances and the scale of this investigation compare with cases that the police force had dealt with before?
I mean, this case was exceptional in Iceland. There had been very few murder cases. I think maybe one murder a year at the most, and always domestic, or you know, it was cases of domestic violence. So the police themselves would say they were completely out of their depth. They'd not seen anything like this before. There had been a murder of a taxi driver in 1973 that had not been resolved. So that was something that had happened recently. But beyond that, this wasn't anything that the police had any experience of at all. And that's still, by the way, the same to this day. Iceland has an extraordinary low rate of homicide in comparison to the rest of the world.
And so we then see this, the scale is then reflected in the media response. Could you talk a little bit about how the media treated the case and treated the suspects as well?
The media reaction was huge. And the timing of the case was important because tabloid journalism had just emerged in Iceland in the sort of mid-70s. And there was about, I think, five or six dailies in Reykjavik that were all competing. And so this story was great fodder for them. So it made the front page for months. And it was lots of different theories and ideas about what had happened. Initially, it was about what had happened to Geirfinna and all kinds of theories about that. But later it became about the people who had been arrested and who they were, and it was, a lot of people have said this was trial by media, you know, that these, obviously it was these guys, you know, they were well known within the Icelandic population. As I mentioned, it was a very small population. Everyone kind of knows everyone. Everyone's somewhat related. So everyone kind of knew who these people were. And it was quite an easy assumption to make that they were guilty.
You mentioned the trial by media, and you also mentioned the comparisons that were made to Charles Manson. What were the comparisons that were drawn, and how do you think it captured public imagination in the same way?
This is kind of touches on what I was saying earlier, which is really about Sai versus Helsinki himself and how easy it was to scapegoat him. And it's partly because, you know, he was this quite a small man, very short guy, I think maybe 5'4", 5'5", with these quite big guys around him. So it's like, how can he control these guys? What's going on here? And also the fact that he didn't use drugs himself, but he sold drugs. So there's always this sense that he was this quite charismatic. And also women liked him a lot. You know, Utler wasn't his only girlfriend. He was very, he drew people to him. He had this huge lack of respect for authority. He was a very unusual person within Iceland, I think, even at the time. So I think that was perhaps why it was quite easy to see him as a kind of controller or a kind of ringleader of this gang.
So the remarkable thing about these confessions is how unreliable they were found to be, as the prisoners were kept in isolation or possibly tortured as well. Can you talk about how you explored that in your film?
There's a whole series of confessions relating to these two disappearances. When I first sort of approached the story, obviously I wanted to find out as much as I could about it, and I read everything I could. And I went back as much as possible to sort of primary source. And the great bulk of that source are these confessions. And there are literally thousands and thousands of pages of court documents of these whole series of confessions relating to the two disappearances. And what's striking is that the confessions keep changing. Not just Ertler's confession that's changing, but it's the others as well. And so it's quite hard to get a handle actually on what the hell's going on with it. And it's only really later in the case, I think a year into the investigation, that they start to kind of, all the confessions start to line up. The police are having a really hard time sort of, you know, getting a viable case that they can actually bring to court. And so at a certain point I think it's in the summer of 1976, they bring in this super cop, this investigator from Germany, called Karl Schutz. And he's a well-known figure who was involved in, for example, in the investigation of the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany. But he's retired now. But he comes to Iceland to help the police and sort of more or less takes control of the investigation. And it's after he arrives that the sort of confessions start to line up and start to be more coherent. And it's some months after he's arrived that he calls a press conference and says, "We've solved the case." And the nightmare is over, is the famous quote that the justice minister said at the time.
And so at what stage then do these confessions start to be questioned?
It was actually quite soon after the guilty verdict that a couple of the defendants or the convicts at that point start to question them and start to say, you know, actually that these were coerced confessions. It's all quite troubling. It's all a bit disorientating, in fact. You know, one of the things that's so striking about this story is when you really look into it, when you really drill into it, is the absence of facts. And maybe that's good for a history program, but, you know, for example, with the first guy who disappeared, you know, we know that he went to the club. We know that he was seen afterwards walking home, maybe with someone, maybe not. And that's it. After that, there's absolutely nothing. There's no body, nothing at all. And with the second guy, similarly, we know that there was this, he went to the cafe, he went back to the cafe, left his car, he had this strange phone call. But once he left his car, no one saw him. There's no witnesses. There's no material evidence. So again, nothing. So what's so striking is the absence of facts and the volume of speculation. Just so, and it seems to me there's such a human thing in a way in this, when you have all these gaps, all this kind of space, this dark void, we need to fill it as humans, I think. We fill it with stories. And so all these stories start to emerge, that whether it's the gossip at the time or whether it's the stories that came out of the police interrogations, they're all just stories. And that's why, in a way, we call it out of thin air. It seems appropriate somehow. The whole thing felt like a giant projection screen. As one of the images I had during the filming was in a cinema screen, a blank cinema screen, onto which we project. And so these hippie characters were the perfect vehicle for that. They were the perfect scapegoat for us to project onto all our fears and fantasies of what maybe happened. And maybe it did happen. I can't say if they did or didn't do it. And actually, that isn't what the film is about in the end. It's not really about innocence or guilt, because of this lack of facts. We can't really say either way. But I think we can say for sure that there was a miscarriage of justice in terms of the way the police handled the investigation. That's for sure.
There's a figure in your film, Gisli Gudjonsson, who refers to memory distrust, which is what the suspects are thought to perhaps have. Can you talk a little bit about what this memory distrust is thought to be?
Gisli thinks five of the six convicts have what he calls a memory distrust syndrome, which is basically when people come to doubt their own memories of what happened to the extent that they sign confessions. I haven't seen that many other stories where this many people have suffered from a memory distrust syndrome.
So when you were creating this film, what did you find may have happened to these people that may have led to memory distrust?
This was one of the things that, you know, people sort of say to me, you know, how can it be possible that people would confess to something like this if they didn't do it? Or even how is it possible that they would have a memory of something that they didn't do? And that was a big question as we were making the film, to sort of try to understand that, and especially Gisli Gudjonsson's ideas of memory distrust syndrome sort of came into play. Gisli is a world leading expert on false confession. I mean, he's an expert witness in the cases of the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six and many other cases around the world. So he's looked very deeply into sort of police interrogation techniques. And he talks a lot about sort of how these false confessions can happen and false memory can happen. And the circumstances under which it can happen. So, for example, extended periods of isolation, presumption of guilt, or very persuasive interrogation techniques high emotional intensity. So it's prolonged, persuasive, repeated police interviews that can really break people down.
Could you talk a little bit about how the case is viewed in Iceland today and kind of what the legacy is within the national consciousness?
One of the reasons why this case still endures is it's the dark mystery. It's unsolved. So nobody knows what happened to Gudmundur. Nobody knows what happened to Geirfinnur. So that's the first thing. But then after that, it's what happened to these six people who were arrested. There's a sort of dark irony at the heart of this, which is that at the time, people thought that this you know, murderous gang symbolized the loss of Icelandic innocence somehow. But actually, the loss of innocence was what the kind of mass hysteria that was created at the time enabled this quite terrible police abuse of power. So there was the loss of innocence was actually what happened next. I always think that's a really kind of crazy thing about this. It's the witch hunt. You know, that's the darkest thing of the story, really.
That was Dylan Howitt speaking to Eleanor Evans. Out of Thin Air will be aired on BBC Four on Monday, the 14th of August at 10 p.m. And it will be available on BBC iPlayer after that.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the turn it up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Well, now it's time for this week's history news with our staff writer, Ellie Cawthorne.
Around 20,000 items have been uncovered during the dredging of Portsmouth Harbour, many of which date back several centuries. More than 3 million cubic metres of sediment were removed during the process. Among everyday items such as shoes, pipes, bottles and plates, some more unusual discoveries were made, including 36 anchors, 8 cannons, an aircraft engine and a human skull thought to date back to the Napoleonic Wars. 5 bombs and a German mine were also found on the seabed. Major disruptions were caused as they were removed to be detonated out at sea. In other news, a stash of aeronautical engineering drawings discovered by accident will be used to rebuild a World War II Mosquito plane. More than 20,000 of the technical diagrams were found in a factory shortly before its demolition. Stored on microfilm cards, the plans include the only complete set of drawings of the Mosquito in existence, as well as several design ideas that were scrapped. There are currently only three of the planes, known as the Wooden Wonder, still in working condition. The newly discovered plans have been donated to a charitable body that intends to restore the shell of a mosquito which crashed in 1949. Ross Sharp, the project's engineering director, said that the discovery of the plans would help combat a, quote, lack of information on the building techniques, materials, fittings and specifications for the aircraft, as well as helping his team to better understand the workings of its engineers.
Now, just before we go, here's a reminder that the August edition of BBC History magazine is currently on sale. This month's issue includes pieces on Passchendaele, the history of witchcraft, the partition of India, and the medieval Black Prince, among other things. Look out for it in all good newsagents and in our many digital formats. Well, we've now come to the end of today's episode, but please do come back for Monday's podcast when we're going to be talking about the history of witchcraft.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.